Reds manager Brian Price dropped 77 F-bombs in less than 6 minutes Monday in his pregame media session. Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, powered by DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy baseball site. Use the promo code DVR to get a free contest entry today with a first-time deposit on DraftKings. I'm Adam Wolf today, and I'm joined today by Clay Link. It's the evening of April 21st, 2015. You can find me on Twitter at WolfmanTweets. You can find Clay on Twitter at ClayWLink. And if you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, really appreciate any rating and review that you can do for this podcast. Just helps us with the feedback and, you know, making sure that things get set in motion further for more podcasts in the future. But going back to that Brian Price thing, Clay, one of the more interesting manager meltdowns I think we've seen in quite some time, just littered with F-bombs all the way.
Yeah, it was really a clown move on his part. I mean, you can't go out and do this. I mean, you wait until the TV cameras leave, kind of cowardly, and you know, any excuse. I know he kind of apologized somewhat for it. He said he stood behind the message, but this does no good for your ball club. Your players see you like this, you know, just kind of, you know, just a bad look, not only, you know, in the players' eyes, but really for the franchise. Just looks bad, and I don't think Brian Price is going to be able to hold up to the pressure of this job. I mean, good pitching coach in his day, but I mean, we're seeing the cracks, and I think it's it's, for me, kind of hard to imagine him surviving the season.
And it just seems like he doesn't really understand how the sports media model works. Mm-hmm. The gripe was with the Cincinnati Inquirer kind of reporting, you know, nuggets of information that Brian Price didn't want to be available. But, you know, the thing is, the guys that were working for the Inquirer aren't employees of the Reds, so I don't understand his frustration with, you know, C. Trent Rosecrans, like, reporting that sort of stuff when, you know, that's his job.
Yeah, exactly. And him saying, you know, this doesn't help the Cincinnati Reds. Like, it's not their job to, you know, filter things, you know, based on what's good for the Reds, what's not good for the Reds. I'm a Reds fan, as most listeners probably know, and I'm pretty embarrassed by this. You know, Brian Price, we'll see how long it goes. And, you know, not everything as far as this season goes has been his fault. I mean, the roster compilation, and you know, it hasn't been great. I mean, the bench is really weak, the bullpen aside from Aroldis Chapman not good, but his management of that bullpen has been bad. And you know, I do give him credit for batting Votto second. I think that was definitely the correct call, but you know, taking last season into account and how he's off this season, I think it's best for the Reds to start looking at other options realistically. And I think it may not be too long. I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, definitely rubbed the front office the wrong way, as well as the Cincinnati media.
Reds got off to a nice start of the season with their first series, kind of have regressed since then, came into play Tuesday, 6-7. We'll touch on the Reds and Brewers game later, along with a lot of other games. But first, let's dive into some of the news and notes from today. First one we'll start off with is related to Corey Dickerson of the Rockies. We touched on it briefly yesterday when I was recording with DVR, but it looks like he left that he was unable to play Monday due to a bout of plantar fasciitis. And anytime you hear that sort of injury, it immediately sounds the alarm that there might be a longer term absence in store. And Dickerson was indeed out of the lineup Tuesday, but it does sound like he plans to play through the injury. Clay, are you optimistic that that's going to go well?
You know, not really, to be honest. And that's coming from a guy who has several shares of Corey Dickerson, had high hopes and was off to a nice start this year. But yeah, you hear plantar fasciitis, definitely worrisome. And, you know, he has played through it to this point. It actually first crept up late in spring training. But manager Walt Weiss said it bit him as he left the batter's box Monday. And I just feel like, you know, while it may not be affecting him much at the plate right now, I feel like in the field, on the base pass, if he's not able to, you know, move well, then, you know, the team may not have a choice but to give him some time to let that, you know, kind of settle down, let the discomfort subside a bit. You know, you can't really do anything right now. Sounds like he's going to try to fight through it. But I think, you know, ultimately, I'm worried that ultimately it will lead to a DL stint.
And if that injury sounds familiar, it was actually what Albert Pujols was dealing with a couple of years ago back in 2013, second year with the Angels, actually. And It was really a terrible season all around. Of course, he's not been the same player since leaving St. Louis, but was limited to 99 games that season, largely due in part to that plantar fasciitis. Don't know if Dickerson's is nearly as severe, but just kind of taking a look at, you know, Pujols' numbers from that season really does give you a little bit of fear that Dickerson, you know, might have to nurse this the rest of the way.
Yeah, and Jed Jerko last year, too, dealt with that, missed a lot of time. Not something you can really turn the page on quickly. That's what's so worrisome to me. They are saying it's a mild case, but at the same time, it's not affecting him right now at the plate, but definitely affected Pujols, as you mentioned, and Jerko to a large extent eventually. I just feel like, you know, so much of your swing with the lower body, if you're not able to properly plant and generate that torque on your swing, it's eventually going to catch up to you.
And fortunately for the Rockies in the short term, they do have a good replacement on hand in Drew Stubbs, one of the better defensive outfielders out there. Of course, does have some issues with making contact, but, you know, he's a pretty good player when you get him against right-handers. And assuming that Dickerson does plan on playing through the injury, we'll have to see how that goes. But Stubbs will be a good, you know, short-term fill-in, at least until Dickerson's injury perhaps sidelines him for longer.
Yeah, and again, Dickerson expects to be able to play through it, but, you know, I would expect maybe the Rockies give him a few more days off here and there. And in the meantime, yeah, Drew Stubbs, pretty nice pickup if you're just looking to stream him here and there at Coors Field. It was starting in center field tonight, pushed Charlie Blackman to left, and, you know, not somebody that really going to make a huge impact for you in mixed leagues, but I think in NL only, definitely worth consideration, and just as a speculative end until you see how this plays out.
On a more positive injury note, Yasiel Puig returned to the lineup Tuesday against the Giants. He'd been battling a hamstring injury for quite a while, and it looked like it was going to result in a DL stint, but evidently showed enough Tuesday morning to get the go-ahead to return to the lineup. We'll have to check in later and see how he does in that game, but is this anything that you're going to be, you know, worried about plaguing him going forward?
You know, I was watching the game that he returned for. I think it was maybe Friday or Saturday. I forget which one.
I think it was
one.
Sunday.
Was it Sunday? Okay, yeah. I was watching that, and he, you know, just didn't look right. He was kind of wincing at times when he had to sprint. And, you know, I was a little worried, but then Don Mattingly came out and said that, you know, no restrictions. He's going to be a full go for this series against the Giants, which is good, especially because, you know, the team brought up Chris Heisey, and well, he hasn't been officially recalled, but he did join the team in San Francisco. Told a reporter that he expects to be officially recalled on Wednesday, which made me think that, man, maybe Puig's going to be a late scratch. Maybe there's something we don't know, but it doesn't sound like it's related to Puig's injury. It just gets you thinking, though. I mean, why would they bring this guy up? I think John Morosi of Fox Sports reported that a trade of an outfielder for the Dodgers is not imminent, so really hard to know exactly what's going on. I mean, Carl Crawford also returned to the lineup today. He's been battling an illness. Hard to know, but definitely reason to speculate here. I don't think it's related to Puig, again, just taking Don Mattingly at face value, but maybe there is something in the works that we don't know about.
And I actually misspoke. It was Saturday that Puig returned to the lineup, was rested Sunday for the series finale against the Rockies. And assuming that Mattingly wasn't, you know, being facetious there or anything like that, it could have been the case where they just didn't want him to play back-to-backs right away, let him get the two-day rest to get back in the lineup Tuesday. So, you know, hopefully that's the case and he is good to go through the Giants series. But those in Daly might want to, you know, just tread carefully a little bit, wait until we, you know, see a few days back of Puig before going right at him. But I think if you're in a weekly league with lineup moves, you're going to want him back in right away.
Yeah, definitely, especially considering how he's done against tonight's starter, Tim Lincecum. And, you know, even when he was hobbled in Saturday's game, still hit the ball really hard, looked really good from what I saw. And so, yeah, Puig's not a guy that you really want to take a wait-and-see approach with. I think you deploy him as normal when he's in the lineup. You know what's interesting? Pure speculation. And again, Morosi said a trade is not imminent, but I think it'd be really interesting for Scott Van Slyke's value if he was dealt. I mean, the team is, you know, has so many outfield options. Van Slyke got to start against a right-hander on Sunday. I think it had a monster game. I think a homer and two doubles. Somebody that I really like is, you know, if he were to work his way into playing time, absolutely destroys lefties and, you know, showed that he can hit right-handers as well. If he works into playing time with another team, I mean, he's a guy that I think even in mixers you want to go out and add right away.
yeah, that's a good point. And considering that Heisey was called up too, that's especially interesting because Alex Guerrero is believed to have some outfield flexibility as well. So you wonder why the Dodgers are pondering making that move. But that's something that perhaps you and Jake can probably touch on and shed some more light on as more information becomes available when we post Wednesday's podcast. But we'll move on to check out an injury for the Nationals. They've been missing Anthony Rendon big time this season, but it looks like he could be nearing the finish line of his recovery. He's going to begin a rehab assignment on Friday. He did play three innings in an extended spring training game Tuesday. Looks like they gave him the go-ahead they set the plan in motion for him to rehab on Friday based on that. He's going to play five more innings at extended spring training on Wednesday, and assuming all goes well, that rehab assignment will be formalized. But it's going to be interesting to see where they plug him back in exactly because they've been using Danny Espinosa and Yunel Escobar at third base some. Could he actually use those guys there? That was initially expected to be Rendon's spot, but looks like they could be pondering to move back to second for him.
Yeah, not really sure of why exactly that is the case, but it does sound like that's a realistic possibility. I think they kind of like Yunel Escobar at third, where he's been helping out recently. Yeah, he has seen some time at second as well, but I just feel like he's going to step back in and reclaim a top spot in that order. I mean, of course, they got Span back to help balance out the top of the order, maybe slot Rendon in second again, and then Escobar takes a big hit. I actually kind of liked him as a decent, deeper mixed league option when he was leading off, but it looks like that's probably going to come to an end pretty soon. Not sure how long of a rehab assignment Rendon will need, but you got to think it's on track for an early May return.
And because of the abbreviated spring training that he had, even if he is back by early May, you probably will want to be a little bit cautious about your usage with him just because you just never know how many days off he's going to get in a given week. But even that, there's a few people that compare to him in terms of what they can provide in the middle infield. So I think in most cases, as was the case with Puig, you're going to want to keep him active as soon as he's back in that lineup.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think owners who got him after the injury are probably going to really profit from their price they got him at, but also I mean, this is somebody who did battle injuries throughout his minor league career, and something you got to keep in mind with this knee. I think it was an MCL sprain. Not something that you really are going to completely turn the page on if you're an owner. You're always going to have that in the back of your mind. Any sort of wincing or pain he's in, you're gonna have to think about that quite a bit if you're an owner. But I think you get him, you throw him back in there, and then if there's any signs, you maybe look to flip him, quite honestly. But I think owners, right now, the value's not there. Maybe if he gets off to a hot start, create a window to sell, but not somebody that I think you're going to get fair value for until he really hits a hot streak. And last year, he was red hot. I mean, really, on this team with so many big hitters, really was the offensive MVP for the Nationals.
The Diamondbacks placed Jake Lamb on the 15-day disabled list Tuesday due to a stress reaction in his left foot. Sounds like he's going to miss around 2 to 3 weeks with that injury. And, with Lamb out of the picture, he had really done a nice job to start the year. It looks like opportunity knocks for Yasmani Tomas to make his debut at third base. He was in the lineup on Tuesday. Don't know if it'll necessarily stick. It seems like Aaron Hill's still a factor in that third base conversation. But, considering the price that Tomas went for in a lot of drafts, I think the people that are rostering him just have to be happy that he's getting some reps at third base finally.
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised by this. I thought they kind of done away with that experiment. Did not go well in spring training, Tomas at third base. I still think he's going to be used primarily off the bench. I think Hill, will probably be the top option there at third base. Not really somebody who's really playing well right now, but I think you have to give him that, and I thought they were doing it earlier in the season when they kind of had him jumping around, maybe showcasing him for a trade. Not really sure, but in the meantime, Jake Letarski and I were kind of differing on this. I think he's really, really only an NL-only option right now until he starts seeing time, but yeah, I think a lot of people paid a hefty price for him in mixed auctions. Going to have to bite the bullet and, use him where they can, give him starts if you're in a league with daily roster moves, but I really don't see him being much of a factor here, and especially if he does not play well at third base, maybe he has a really short leash, especially after how poorly he did in spring training. I think that, you know, if he doesn't play well there, you know, there's not going to be really any opportunities for him, especially in the outfield.
I'd probably agree with you on the NL-only recommendation right now for Tomas. I know that's probably not what a lot of people want to hear, considering, you know, what he went for in drafts, but it just seems like a lot of people were looking at, you know, the Cuban pedigree and, you know, the pipeline of talent that have come through the big leagues and just figured that Tomas would immediately, you know, find success. But it's not always that easy. For every Jose Abreu, there's a Dion Viciedo that doesn't pan out for whatever reason. And I hope that Tomas isn't necessarily Viciedo, but, you know, you just have to, you know, tread cautiously with guys you don't have a whole lot of data on.
Yeah, and I know DVR threw this out there on a podcast recently about, you know, Tomas already has a diet plan for next spring training. Like, when you're already looking ahead to next spring training, that's not a great sign. He did show some impressive power in spring training. I will give him that. But it was pretty much all opposite field. It seemed like he had some trouble getting around on the fastball. And, yeah, everything will depend on how he does at third base. If he plays all right, then maybe the team, you know, tries to, you know, gives him more time and just kind of turns the page on Aaron Hill. But I just don't think, you know, he's gonna play well enough to warrant that. And you know, as far as how he does hitting, I mean, the only four pinch hit appearances, not really much to get excited about. He's somebody that I think, you know, the Diamondbacks are really gonna regret signing to that deal. Book's still out, obviously, and really we won't know for years to come. He's only 24 years old. But as far as this season goes, I mean, in dynasty leagues, I'd hold on to him. Maybe you want to, if he was bought for cheap and, you know, contract issues or, you know, based on his contract in dynasty keeper leagues, you know, don't want to say, you know, buy low, because of course that's kind of been kind of a myth realistically. But I think there may be a window, you know, while he's, you know, his playing time is minimal right now, to maybe go out and grab him at a reasonable price, maybe 70 cents on the dollar. But, you know, that's really if you're looking ahead to future years and not going for it this season.
Let's take a look at Christian Yelich. It looks like he's going to miss a couple days due to a back injury. Scratched from Tuesday's lineup, was supposed to play initially, but it ended up that he was experiencing some renewed back tightness that resulted in him being pulled from the lineup. So it sounds like that he won't be available until the weekend at the earliest. But you have to wonder, is this going to be something that persists, you know, heading into, you know, next weekend beyond, even before that back injury? He did deal with that earlier in the week, but returned from injury to play four games. Looked like in the last two games he wasn't really himself, struck out 7 times in 10 at-bats, a guy that typically makes a lot of contact. So do you wonder if the back tightness might have played into his struggles the last couple of days, and you wonder if it's going to continue going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of worried about this, just given how long it's really been lingering. It's been a decent amount of time since he's, you know, first been, you know, scratched with these issues. I mean, I think it was, you know, officially just on the 14th of April, but I think there may have been some signs of him, you know, dealing with some of that throughout spring training. I mean, that's kind of speculation. There wasn't reports on that, but just given how long this has lingered around, I know DVR has said that, you know, back issues, well, more so spasms, but spasms are really more of a symptom than anything else, than, you know, an injury of their own. This is being labeled tightness, but he said just today that it's pretty locked up right now. I mean, when the back locks up like that, you know, and it can do that, you know, even after days of rest and, you know, returning to the lineup, you think you turn the page on it, springs back up. I think it's kind of an issue where, you know, I'm treading carefully here if I'm a Yelich owner. Of course, there's not really much you can do now, but I think you have to be a bit concerned given how long this has gone on for.
Is it something that's going to motivate you to pursue a trade right now, or probably not, just because you wouldn't get, you know, full value just based on him being injured?
Yeah, I mean, if I was looking to go out and acquire him, yeah, maybe I'd test the waters. But again, it's something where, you know, the owner of Christian Yelich, given the price they paid for him, probably a top 5 or 6 round pick, probably $20 to $23 range in auctions. I don't think they're going to be willing to, you know, throw him out there for anything less than probably 90 cents on the dollar. But yeah, I mean, if the owner's panicking, maybe they're off to a slow start. Maybe you see what you have to give up to get him. As far as trades go, I'm really just the kind of guy that just reaches out and says, what will it take to get this guy? And maybe you do that, see what the price is, but it's not something that if I'm an owner, I'm looking to trade him whatsoever.
And as far as a short-term ramifications from Yelich being out of the lineup. It looks like Ichiro got in the lineup today, would presumably get the bulk of the playing time if Yelich is indeed expected to miss a couple more days. Maybe Martin Prado gets a couple reps in left field. Jeff Baker could perhaps be an alternative there. But really, this team isn't built to handle a long-term absence for Yelich. None of those guys profile as everyday players at this stage of their career.
No, definitely not. I mean, Ichiro, you know, he's still got plenty of speed for a guy his age. Maybe a decent daily option. I mean, he's not somebody that I'm going to recommend going out and picking up in any game. But, I mean, he's more than likely going to be starting, you know, in the next couple of days, probably the final two games of the Phillies series as well as today. And, I mean, he's got Cole Hamels up tomorrow. Not really a great option as a lefty bat. Does have a hit and three at-bats against Hamels. Probably not somebody I want to use in daily tomorrow, but maybe Thursday, maybe give him a roll. And if it lingers, I mean, if Yelich isn't back this weekend, maybe you think about adding him in NL only.
One thing that we were really excited about buzzing around the office was the debut of Addison Russell on Tuesday night. Kind of alluded to it on Monday's podcast that the Cubs were making waves that he might, you know, come up eventually just because he'd been seeing some reps at second base. And it looks like the team wasted no time in bringing him aboard. Arizmendi Alcantara, I believe, was sent down to make room for Russell. Russell was batting ninth in his debut. We'll check in on that later just to see how he did. But as far as, you know, for the foreseeable future, it looks like he'll be locked into second base. What kind of expectations do you have for him?
Well, yeah, I mean, my excitement was kind of tempered when I saw he was batting behind the pitcher tonight, but same time, I kind of understand where Joe Maddon's coming from. I mean, second leadoff type of guy for now. Make him earn his way to a more prominent spot in the order. I have pretty high expectations for Russell. I went out and added him where I could. Added him even in a 10-team mixed head-to-head points league. I mean, just as a flyer, thought I'd give him a roll. I mean, I had Jordy Mercer as my shortstop, and he is shortstop eligible in a lot of leagues. He's going to be playing second, though, as you mentioned. I think when I saw in his debut, 0-for-3 with two strikeouts, not how you want to start, but of course Chris Bryant struggled in his debut and has been really heating up recently. I mean, this guy, I mean, maybe overshadowed by Bryant. I mean, Bryant was my top prospect coming into the year and, you know, easily overshadowed, but really Russell, top five overall prospect in all of baseball. So maybe it takes him a little while, still just 21, but was off to a nice start at AAA. I think he works his way up maybe into I don't know about a top third, but maybe the sixth spot in the order, somewhere around there eventually. And, you know, in that lineup, I mean, there's a lot to like, run scoring potential. I mean, he's really got all the tools you want. He's somebody that, yeah, I mean, I picked up everywhere. I'm not going to throw him in my lineup everywhere right away, but somebody that I think, you know, in time could be a big difference maker for those who were able to, you know, get out ahead of their other owners and add him.
And because of his standing as such a highly regarded prospect in leagues where you can't make those immediate ads, where you have the weekly auction, you have to think that Russell's price is going to be pretty high, 10 team leagues, just because, you know, the reputation that he does carry and the scarcity in the middle infield alone. As far as, you know, let's say a 12-team league with a $100 auction budget, what price range do you think you'd feel comfortable throwing out a bid on Russell?
Man, that's tough. I think, you know, I want to say, like, hey, 90, but that's not how you play the game. I mean, you want to keep it realistic, but for a player of this caliber, I mean, I think 40 to 50% of your budget is reasonable. I mean, especially if you're really hurting in the middle infield. You know, I've seen in some of our leagues, closers go for $57, $52. I think that was the price on Jason Grilli and Adam Ottavino. I think Russell easily warrants that much. I didn't like those prices for those pitchers. But if that's how much those guys were going for, I mean, you know, maybe even up to 60%. I'd be fine with that, honestly, just because I'm such a believer in Addison Russell.
Yeah, it really depends, I think, on your comfort level in you trusting Russell's skill set to immediately find success at the major league level. I'm more conservative generally with my bids. I like to have, you know, low money bids at my disposal where I can add multiple players throughout the year, so I'm not constantly being beat by everybody else when it comes to auction time the rest of the way. But if you are a firm believer in Russell, it's probably going to take a pretty hefty commitment to acquire him in your FAB budget.
Exactly. And I've said it before. I punted middle infield in a lot of drafts and auctions I did. Adding Russell, I mean, he's the kind of guy who you can, yeah, I mentioned you really separate yourself with his addition to your club. If that's the final piece you need and you're really confident that that's going to put you over the hump, I mean, he's not a closer. He's the kind of guy that I would be more willing to go a higher price on, but at the same time, anything higher than 60% of your budget, I would advise against. But I think right around there, if you're really in desperate need, then I think that's justifiable at least.
While we're talking about some of those roster additions as the end of the week approaches, one of the other names that you might want to consider is Rafael Montero. Doesn't sound like he's going to get a permanent spot in the Mets rotation, but he will be called up to start Monday against the Marlins. Marlins that might be, you know, without Christian Yelich and aren't exactly playing that well right now. Could he be a good spot start even in, you know, a deeper mixed league or an NL only league?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's speculation, you know, kind of like we were doing with Chris Heisey and the Dodgers earlier, but I really think this could be an anticipation of a deal or maybe Dylan G moving to the bullpen. I mean, G not off to a good start by any means. And you know, I don't think you bring a guy up just for the one start, just so you can roll with a six-man rotation for one turn. I just think that there's maybe something they're not letting on, and he's got the stuff to make an impact. I actually picked him up in my NL only, but then ended up dropping him for Addison Russell. But I think that he's the kind of guy who you would be an upgrade over Dylan G. And if you want to, you know, if there were to be a news piece that broke that saying Dylan G was traded, I mean, Montero would be an ad in pretty much all formats, but maybe not, you know, shallower 10-teamers, but 12 to 15 teams and beyond, I think Montero would definitely be picked up in that case. And if he has a rotation spot, I definitely like what he brings to the table. I mean, wasn't a relief role to start the year, but they sent him back down to AAA to get stretched out, really the only reason he was sent down. Coming back up, if he performs well, it really could be a two-start week for him, starting Monday, and then you think he'd probably get another turn if he fares well. And if he were to stick in there long-term, really could return nice value.
Doesn't get the buzz that somebody like Noah Syndergaard does, but, you know, a pretty good prospect in his own right. Actually posted better numbers than Syndergaard last year at AAA Las Vegas, which arguably the toughest park in all of minor league baseball to pitch. Didn't really have that much success in his cups of coffee with the Mets this year and last, but just, you know, the standing that he has as succeeding at just about every level that he's been to has to give you some confidence with acquiring him.
Yeah, averaged almost a strikeout per inning throughout his minor league career, 8.6 K per nine. Control really been a part of his profile all along, 2.1 walks per nine. It has, you know, taken a dip as he's moved up the minor league ladder, you know, 3.8 at AAA last year, walks per nine, 3.4 so far this year, really small sample, just 2.2 innings. But I think, you know, in time that the control he showed throughout the lower levels will show up in the majors. And, yeah, you got to take the 3.16 ERA and 1.28 whip with a grain of salt. But at the same time, you know, those are numbers at a, you know, very tough place to pitch, as you mentioned, and very respectable. I think the, you know, 80 to 34 K to walk really kind of speaks for itself at AAA last year.
RotoWire listeners are winning serious money at DraftKings.com. Baseball season is heating up, and you too could be winning some serious cash. You need to check out DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy sports site. Use the promo code DVR when you deposit for a free contest entry today. And Clay, as per usual, big slate on Wednesday. It's actually not divided into day games and night games, only one day game. So if you're playing daily, it's going to have to be concentrated on the night games. What are some value picks that you like?
Well, you know, I had a tough realization last week just getting clobbered in one of our deeper tournaments. Really can't skim on pitching anymore. I always try to scrape the bottom of the barrel. And my conversion rate, my success rate, pretty low. That's why I really like Johnny Cueto. 9,500 at Milwaukee. You know, I think he's the fifth priciest pitcher, which, you know, is understandable, reasonable, but I think you pay that premium for a guy like that. Milwaukee, really kind of a mess right now, kind of exploded in these later couple innings tonight against Cincinnati, putting up a 10 spot, but Cincinnati's got a 16 on the board against Milwaukee as we talk currently. But I think Cueto is a guy that, you know, against this depleted lineup is going to breeze through him. Maybe it's too obvious. Maybe you want to go with a guy who's lower on the board, and some of your bigger tourneys. And if that's the case, I do like Doug Pfister as a cheaper secondary option, $7,400 against St. Louis. St. Louis entering Tuesday's action, 11th in the NL in runs scored with 43 only, 683 OPS. And last I saw, they were getting shut out 1-0 tonight. So, I mean, I think that they're a team that's really getting by on the name brand right now and not really living up offensively to what they were billed as. And, you know, I mentioned don't like scraping the bottom of the barrel, but J.A. Happ at 6,400 against Houston. Houston striking out a ton, and Happ off to a really nice start. I do think Houston's going to bust out eventually one of these days, but I think Happ, you know, as a lefty, I mean, maybe there is some reason to be, you know, hesitant there, but I think he makes for a decent option at 6,400. And on the offensive side, I mean, I'm picking on Eric Stoltz so long as he's in the rotation for the Braves. I mean, the Mets, you know, a lot of their bats, lefty bats that I like right now, but I think you stack up with some of their right-handers against Stoltz, makes for some pretty good plays. I mean, John Mayberry, you want to be sure he's in there, but 5-for-11 mark against Stoltz, I think he will be. 2,600, dirt cheap. Michael Kadire, 4,200. He's just 1-for-8 against Stoltz, but I think, you know, he's bound to turn that around eventually against the soft-tossing lefty. Wilmer Flores, still pretty cheap at 3,700. He's hit a couple homers so far this year. And Kevin Plawecki. I mean, Travis d'Arnaud out. Manager Terry Collins did confirm that Plawecki's going to be the primary option behind the plate. 2,700. Get him while he's cheap. I mean, a couple hits tonight, a couple singles in his debut. I think against Stoltz, that's a great matchup for him. You'll want to confirm, even though Collins did say he's the primary option, you want to confirm that he is going to get the start. But I think at that price, I mean, there's very few options as appealing, just given how low that dollar value is.
Kind of like the recommendation you made on Pfister, kind of a middle of the road as far as price goes for the Tuesday slate. And really good point that you made about the Cardinals. I know a couple of years ago when, you know, Matt Carpenter, I think, put up 120 runs and Carlos Beltran was hitting 26, 30 homers. Really one of the more potent offenses in the NL. But even last year, they regressed pretty noticeably. And I think a lot of people kind of took that for granted. I know you look at their depth chart and you see, wow, there's really not too many holes in that lineup. But for whatever reason, they really haven't put it together over the last year and change right now. And as you said, they rank 11th in the NL with runs scored right now. I kind of expect them to maybe, you know, improve off that mark, but I don't think they should be considered as an elite offense. And with a team like the Nationals, you have to think that Pfister is going to be in good position for the win.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, they did have 8 hits against Gio Gonzalez tonight, but only they were able to muster a run, but ended up losing 2-1. Not really living up to expectations right now. Jason Hayward 0-for-5 tonight with a strikeout. Matt Holliday 4-for-4. But aside from that, Yadier Molina, Colton Wong, they had multiple hits, but really the middle of that lineup is really struggling right now. And Matt Carpenter, I mean, he's off to a really nice start, but I think you know, Pfister's the kind of guy who is going to get a lot of ground balls, not going to strike out a lot of guys, but I think he's a tough matchup for this team.
Two of the teams with potent offenses that are kind of meeting expectations right now, the Orioles and the Jays. They got together tonight, put up a lot of runs on the board, and I kind of see the same thing happening for the Wednesday slate. You got Ubaldo Jimenez. Of course, he's off to a great start this season, actually hasn't allowed a run just yet, but you know, his performance the last 3 of the last 4 seasons, he had a good season in 2013 with the Indians, but other than that, he's pretty much been a mess you know, since that remarkable campaign with Colorado. Have to think that he's not going to get by you know, without any marks on his record on Wednesday. And Aaron Sanchez on the hill for the Blue Jays in that one. Guy that has a lot of hype coming into the year just based on his standing as one of the Blue Jays' top pitching prospects, but really hasn't put it together in his 2 starts so far. A lot of runners on base, hasn't gone more than 6 innings. I think the control might still be an issue for Sanchez in that starting role. So I do think that there is an opportunity here for the bats to explode for both the Orioles and the Jays. You know, the usual suspects that you typically want to center your roster around, the Adam Joneses of the world, Edwin Encarnacion. I think they both make for good plays. But if you are looking for cheaper options to kind of fill out a stack, a lot of good options at your disposal, particularly with the lefty bats on both sides against these two right-handers. Some of the cheaper priced options that I might like are Dalton Pompey. He's available for $4,000. One that I really like is Everth Cabrera. He's 3,200 and he's batting leadoff right now with both of the Orioles middle infielders and Jonathan Scope and J.J. Hardy sidelines. So a lot of profit potential there. A couple other names, Alejandro D'Aza, Travis Snyder for the Orioles, and for the Jays, Deonner Navarro or Justin Smoke. Not all of these guys are going to get in the lineup probably, but you'll just want to obviously keep track and kind of mine for some of those cheap value plays that are inserted into favorable parts of the lineup.
You know, I like that call, especially because Ubaldo, I mean, you mentioned off to a great start, and actually one of those starts did come against the Blue Jays, and he's actually had great success against the Blue Jays throughout his career, but now's about the time when the wheels will start coming off. I mean, the control issue's got to catch up to Ubaldo eventually. And a lot of those guys you mentioned in the bottom half, you know, aside from Batista and Encarnacion, who both homered tonight, Pompey, Cabrera, D'Aza, Snyder, Smoke, you know, most of those guys, sub $4,000 prices. I think that's a good call. I really like D'Aza this year. You know, he was the most expensive of those kind of secondary guys you mentioned, but he's somebody that I think is really undervalued in season long. And I think as far as a daily play goes, you slot him in there, make sure he's, you know, batting near the top of the order. But I think if that's the case, I mean, you got those heavy hitters behind him, you know, great source of runs, and he even has some pop as he's shown so far.
As far as daily goes, I know you said that Jimenez has had some success against the Blue Jays before. I don't personally put a lot of stock in pitcher versus team matchup or even batter versus hitter all the time, just because it's such a small sample relative to, you know, what's out there. I think generally the lefty-righty matchups are a better barometer of where you can kind of exploit that type of value. But, you know, it does sometimes aid decisions. I mean, the numbers that Puig has against Lincecum obviously helped, you know, the cause of keeping him active. But I would just say to the listeners out there that you're going to want to, you know, don't lose the trees in the forest, or however the saying goes. Just make sure that you're, you know, looking at the largest sample possible in order to guide your decisions.
You know, I'm with you there. And, you know, we have the lineup card on the site every day, and we have the hot, cold matchups, hot pitchers, hot, cold pitchers and whatnot. And I agree that, you know, you want to take the sample size into account, definitely. But I think even if a pitcher has faced a guy 10, 15 times, I think that's enough to get a decent read. I mean, if he's only had, you know, three or four hits, not really much. But if he's hit him, you know, over 50% of the time he's faced him, I think you can't write that off entirely. Jimenez's success against the Blue Jays, I'm with you that, you know, that sample is small enough to where I'd put stock in the Jays breaking out of that, because we know who Ubaldo is, and we know who the Blue Jays are. I mean, so many potent bats in that lineup that eventually it's going to even out.
And if you played the Jays in the Tuesday slate, you had a lot of success. We'll take a look at the Jays-Orioles game from Tuesday night. 13-6 affair with the Jays coming out on top. 16 hits leading the parade were Deonner Navarro. He went 3-for-5. Dalton Pompey went 3-for-4 with 3 runs scored. Josh Donaldson also continued his hot start to the season with a 3-for-4 showing. And Edwin went deep twice, both of the solo variety, for his third and fourth homer of the year, along with Bautista also connecting on his fourth homer of the year. And I have to think that, you know, I don't think a 13-6, 20-run affair is going to break out on Wednesday, but anytime a team gets together at the Rogers Center, especially two teams of this kind of offensive firepower, you have to think that a lot of runs are going to be put on the board.
Yeah, you have to, and especially when you got, you know, Bud Norris on the bump for the Orioles. Gave him 9 earned runs in this one. 6 hits, 3 walks, only 2 Ks. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know Kevin Gausman's had some struggles so far this year, but I would really like to see him maybe supplant him in the lineup or in the rotation. That's just me. Don't know if they have any plans to do so. And again, Gausman has struggled, but I would like to see that. Good to see Jose Reyes, you know, get in there and steal a base too. He's been dealing with some rib issues, but nice to see him mobile and able to do so. Only his second of the year, but you know, not bad. Good to see there. On the Orioles side offensively, I mean, you mentioned Cabrera leading off. You know, he had a pair of hits. Steve Pierce really slumping right now, 0-for-5 tonight, now batting 156. Had a, you know, couple homers to start the year, but this is kind of getting troubling. I kind of feel like a move back down in the order may be coming for him.
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility considering, you know, all the alternatives that the Orioles do have in their outfield. Chris Davis now back from that suspension that he had to start the year. So definitely could see a scenario where Pierce has moved out for somebody like Delman Young or Jimmy Paredes, who had a really nice game over the weekend, could even get some reps if Pierce's struggles continue. So that's something that you'll definitely want to keep your eye on.
Yeah, Manny Machado just 1-for-3 tonight, batting 167 for the year. He could be a candidate to move up, but he's got to start swinging it a little better before that becomes realistic. And, you know, you mentioned Diana Navarro was a nice streaming daily option for tomorrow. He had 3 hits in this one. I think he's really kind of undervalued in most circles just because he doesn't have that starting job behind the plate anymore, but seeing a lot of time at DH.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And in daily formats especially, that's where you can really get the most value out of Navarro. But even in deep two-catcher leagues where he still obviously has eligibility from last year, even without that regular role, there's still probably enough justification to keep him out there as your second catcher if you're in a 12- or 15-team league.
Yeah, he's a guy that I kept at a buck in Staff Keeper League 1, just given the scarcity at the position. Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty nice option. Batting fifth tonight, I mean, don't know if that's always the case. I forget exactly how their lineup has been shaking out, and Martin has been playing really well, but Navarro batting ahead of Martin in this one, and you throw him in the middle of that lineup, I mean, tons of RBI opportunity. No RBI in his 3 hits tonight, but those will come.
The other AL East matchup on Tuesday was a little bit quieter. Red Sox beat the Rays by a 1-0 count. Wasn't really a pitcher's duel because neither of the starters went 2 innings, but pretty good outings in any case from Wade Miley, who got the win. Was only limited to 5 2/3 innings just because he walked 4 batters and kind of run up his pitch count a little bit, but didn't allow a run to get his first win of the year. Chris Archer getting the loss on the other side for the Rays. Struck out 9 batters, did give up a run, but it was unearned. So looks like another good outing for Chris Archer, who's really done a nice job to help cover for the absence of Alex Cobb to start the year.
Yeah, I really like what Archer's doing. And yeah, you mentioned taking the loss, tough loss without giving up an earned run. 9 Ks, 1.07 ERA on the year. You know, I was kind of hyping him up as a big, you know, breakout candidate, and he really is living up to expectations so far. Wade Miley, I mean, 4 walks to 3 strikeouts, not great by any means, but good to see him get on track. And that bullpen for Boston really, you know, came through for him. Alexi Ogando, Junichi Tozawa, Koji Uehara, I mean, they're all, you know, really solid options at the back end of that bullpen. I think Edward Mojica, you know, he's had some struggles this year, kind of down in the pecking order. I do like Tozawa as a speculative guy to go out and grab it, and if you're looking for saves, you know, kind of scouring for saves, because I think he might actually be next in line now. Hasn't given up an earned run this season, and you know, Uehara is really, you know, not throwing the fastball a lot. Last I saw, I mean, I was looking on fan graphs, velocity is down and really was kind of shying away from the fastball. I mean, we've seen Masahiro Tanaka have some success with that recently, but he also struggled early on not throwing that fastball, hard to get by without you know, having a good number of those in there. If he were to, you know, lose that job, I think Tozawa could step right in. Of course, Uehara, so many injury issues throughout his career. Maybe only a matter of time before Tozawa gets another chance. He had a brief run as the closer, I think in late 2013. I think he, you know, really kind of fits that role. And I think he'd, you know, especially on a team like Boston, could be a great source of saves.
Definitely worried about Uehara as an owner of him. I know, coming off the disabled list, he's thrown 3 great outings on the surface, hasn't allowed a run, has struck out 4 batters, 2 saves, 1 win. So from that perspective, he's doing a great job right now. But I think this might be the ultimate time to sell high on him while you can, just because he's 40 years old. Injury concerns aren't foreign to him, obviously. So that's just something that you have to, you know, take into consideration with any valuation of Uehara. So while he's pitching well, I think this might be the time to move him, you know, while you can get maximum value.
Man, I think you're dead on there, because this is not taking tonight's outing into account, but just his first couple, you know how much he threw the fastball, which is actually right around 88 miles per hour where it was last year, but throwing it just 12.5% of the time, down from 50.1% last year. He's throwing the split finger way more, almost double as often as he did last year, 87.5%, just 47.6% last season. So, you know, so much reliance on that split finger, you know, hard to imagine that he's going to be able to get by throwing that almost 90% of the time. I think, you know, there's some underlying issues here. You're right, they're not showing up on the surface yet, but some reasons to be concerned with Uehara for sure.
Doesn't have a lot of velocity to begin with, and considering how he broke down in the last month or two of last season, you have to think that might be in order for the same type of thing again if he's forced to rely that heavily on his secondary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty troubling. And again, go out and add Junichi Tozawa if you can. Uehara's, yeah, this is the ideal time to sell. And I would even take a hit on value. I mean, at least on the surface, I would sell. Yeah, if there's a speculative guy that you really kind of like, or if you have a need elsewhere, maybe take a bit of a hit. You know, as far as surface value, as it looks right now, you may be taking a bit of a hit. Maybe you catch some flack in the message boards, but I think it'll be worth it long term.
Let's take a look at the Phillies and Marlins. And the Phillies were a team that I actually recommended as a cheap, sneaky stack in daily play for Tuesday. And while it looks like that they did end up putting 7 runs on the board and ultimately coming away with a 7-3 victory, guys that I was kind of targeting, guys like Odubel Herrera didn't necessarily go off, but some of the old standbys did. Ryan Howard connected on his first homer of the year, finished the night with a 2-for-3 slate with 2 RBIs and 2 runs scored. Ben Revere also went 1-for-3 with 2 RBIs and his 4th stolen base of the year. Dan Heron chased after 4 innings, struck out 7 in 6, but did give up 4 runs and walked 3, while Jerome Williams got the win on the other side for the Phillies. But loss drops the Marlins to 3-11. Hard to think that they're that far back in the standings already, right in the territory with the Brewers, a team, yeah. Both teams actually have kind of figured to be in contention this year. And, you know, the Yelich injury factors into this too. You have to wonder, if the Marlins will even be a .500 team this year. They've just got a lot of ground to make up now.
Yeah, I mean, early, but yeah, especially given how active they were in the offseason. That's really kind of the difference between the Brewers and the Marlins. Whereas the Brewers didn't really do anything this offseason. They didn't sell any pieces. They didn't bring in really any quality pieces. Marlins really went all in, went out and got, you know, of course, Martin Prado, Mike Morris, D. Gordon, I mean, and several additions to the rotation as well. This is not what you want to see. I think that there's still enough here to where they should push for a wild card spot. I like them making the move from Jared Saltzamacchia to JT Realmuto. I think that he's, you know, athletic 24-year-old, going to, you know, provide a sense of excitement there and maybe provide a spark at the back half of that batting order. But I think Mike Redmond may have to go.
And one of the few additions that has worked out is D. Gordon. He went 2-for-5, also stole his 7th base of the season to bring his average up to .390, not really drawing a lot of walks as you might expect. The OBP is only 10 points higher than his batting average, but have to be impressed with what you've seen from D. Gordon. I wasn't really expecting him to maintain the level that he showed with the Dodgers last year, but to his credit, he's thriving right now.
Yeah, he is. And I think, you know, I was down on him. I was pretty much ready to write him off coming into last season, but really a nice career resurgence for him. And looks like, you know, he's going to be setting the table and really, you know, kind of keeping the Marlins at least in a lot of these games with his performance. I think Mike Morris may be a pretty big whiff on their part as far as the front office goes. I think, you know, he's kind of a guy that's, it's going to have his ups and downs. I mean, he should get hot eventually, but as your guy to really protect Stanton, I don't think he's going to hit enough to where teams are really going to have to attack Stanton. And Marcelo Ozuna, too. I mean, batting .262 right now, but I have issues with him and his ability to hit for a decent average the rest of the way.
In other NL East action, the Mets moved to 11-3 by beating the Braves 7-1 on Tuesday. Doing the bulk of the damage for the Mets was Curtis Granderson. He went 3-for-5 at the top of the order with 4 RBI. Juan Lagares right behind him went 1-for-4 with 2 RBI. Also, 2-hit performances from Wilmer Flores and Kevin Plawecki making his MLB debut. Very impressive with a 2-for-4 showing, 2 runs scored while batting, it looks like, in the 7th spot in the order. Plawecki, I talked about yesterday with DVR when, you know, Travis d'Arnaud obviously going to be out for a while. How do you compare Plawecki to some of the other catching options that might be out there on the waiver wire this coming week?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, catcher injuries right now with not only d'Arnaud, but, I mean, Devin Mesoraco. I mean, his status is up in the air. A lot of, I mean, obviously Jonathan Lucroy as well. I think they handed him a 4-to-6-week timetable today. A lot of people scrambling to replace some catcher options. You know, I actually think I'd rather have Realmuto by a hair, but this is an encouraging performance from Plawecki. Again, I like him and Flores tomorrow to repeat these strong outings, but you know, Plawecki's still really young. I think it may take him a bit, but I mean, the team context is favorable. I guess pretty much neck and neck with Real Muto. But I know, I mean, a guy like Derek Norris is unowned in some leagues and shallower leagues. Definitely have him atop the list if you're, you know, in a shallower league and really need a catcher. He's batting second for the Padres. But I think Plawecki's a guy that should be owned really in all 12 to 15 team leagues.
Only offense for the Braves in this game came from Cameron Maben's solo homer. He was hitting at the top of the order, only batting 147 so far in his brief Braves career. But, you know, with Eric Young Jr. not doing much better, it looks like the Braves are kind of just going to, you know, take a loss in the center field production most night. Although, you know, regardless, both guys, because they profile as speed guys, are going to probably bat, you know, high in the lineup whenever they're in the lineup.
Yeah, I think this was the third straight start for Maben, third day on the bench, straight day on the bench for Eric Young Jr., and I think that's the right move. You got to have Maben in there. I mean, batting just 147 so far, but three homers, and somebody who's, you know, really hasn't lived up to expectations, of course, but I think he'll get his run at near everyday time moving forward, and somebody that I like to play pretty well. I mean, there's a chance that, you know, Eric Young Jr. could see time in left against right-handed pitching with Johnny Gomes, you know, in a soft platoon there. But I think between Maben and Eric Young, even though, you know, EY has the stolen base upside definitely in his favor, I like Maben more, not only because of the way the playing time's trending, but also just as far as skills and, you know, fantasy contributions go. I think he'll be the more valuable asset.
Let's take a look at that Cubs-Pirates game that we alluded to earlier with Addison Russell making his major league debut and really kind of looked a lot like what we saw from Chris Bryant in his major league debut. Three strikeouts and five at-bats, failed to record a hit while batting that ninth spot in the lineup. Obviously, not something you want to panic over just yet, but probably won't be moving out of that bottom third spot in the order anytime soon after Tuesday's performance.
Well, not in the days ahead, I'd say, but I think it will be not that long before he's back up there. I mean, Cristian Orfia, Wellington Castillo. I mean, obviously Castillo's not the top option there, but I think he can surpass those guys. Yeah, he's going to have to earn his way up, though. Like I said, I mean, Joe Maddon's really going to make him swing his way up, and I think that happens eventually. But for now, you know, behind some pretty poor options there. But he did leave three on base tonight, so, you know, I think he will have plenty of RBI opportunities. The stolen base potential, though, may not be there until he earns his way up a little bit higher. Chris Bryant, though, another double tonight, now has three on the young season. And just like with Bryant, I think it's, you know, you got to put this slow, you know, disappointing debut to the side and really look ahead and not overreact at all.
And the thing with Russell, I think to expect him to be like Bryant, where the expectations were sky high immediately, I think that's a little bit unfair to Russell. Bryant was a college bat, a guy that was a little more developed, had more time in the upper minors than Russell has had. So some growing pains can be expected from Russell. I don't necessarily think he's going to be an immediate star at the position like a lot of people projected for Bryant. So that has to be taken into consideration. But just to go back on what Bryant has done so far, hasn't homered yet, but really is pretty much delivering what everybody kind of thought. Three doubles already. RBIs coming in droves, batting in that fourth spot in the lineup, currently upholding a 4.44 batting average. So really hard to find any flaws with what he's done so far.
Yeah, I'm with you, and wish I had some shares, but not this year. I mean, the price crept up a bit too high for me, but I have to make up for it on DraftKings in the days and weeks ahead. But on the other side, I mean, Josh Harrison with the homer, but really Starling Marte has impressed me a hell of a lot so far this year. Fifth homer tonight. It seems like every other day he's going yard for the Pirates. Somebody who, you know, was definitely high on coming in the year, but I should have been even more aggressive. Wish I had landed him more spots. And, you know, Jung Ho Gung, good to see him get a double, bases clearing double tonight. Three RBI there, two hits. You know, with Jordy Mercer dealing with some injury issues, I mean, there could be an opportunity for him to play a decent bit and really work his way into at least a part-time role.
They did say that x-rays were negative on the rib injury that Mercer sustained, I believe it was Sunday, but In any case, a couple starts probably will be coming Kane's way over the next few days. So that might make him an attractive selection in daily play or, you know, in deeper leagues, just, you know, as a weekly ad, just because of the playing time that will be headed his way. Did have a advanced bat when he was in Korea. Obviously, you have to be, you know, a little bit wary of how that might translate. But what he showed on Tuesday was pretty impressive.
Mark Melanson blew a save, too. I mean, this is getting troubling with him. 3 earned runs tonight in an inning, 3 hits, 2 walks, a strikeout. I mean, really not impressive so far this season. I know Jeff Erickson's been kind of touting Archimedes Caminero as a decent speculative ad, throwing gas and whiff rate, swing and miss, swing strike rate is really through the roof. So I'm kind of with them that, especially in NL only, if you got an extra roster spot, maybe think about adding him because the way things are going right now for Melanson, hard to really see him. I mean, I think he has a decent leash, but if he keeps going this way, they're going to have to make a change.
The velocity, I think, is what's really concerning about Melanson. Just taking a look at his numbers, currently averaging in the high 80s on his fastball. He was pretty much in the low 90s, 92, 93 mile per hour range the last few years. So to see the drop of that extent for a guy only 30 years old, you have to wonder if he might, you know, be falling off a cliff or dealing with some sort of dead arm phase maybe. And that might obviously complicate his hold on the closer's role, especially with a guy like Caminero who does throw gas, guy like Tony Watson that was really effective as a setup man last year. The Pirates aren't starved for alternatives, so you have to think if Melanson might have another blow-up, Clint Hurdle could make that change.
Yeah, I think that's a realistic possibility. I know people drafted Melanson thinking that, you know, he was really secure in that role, and he did have security coming in, but, you know, even performance in 2 weeks, you know, definitely has shortened that leash, and I think that, you know, this is only his first blown save of the year tonight, but you mentioned the velocity issues. Really hasn't been sharp. I think people may look at that one blown save and be like, hey, he still has a ways to go. But I think that he's really kind of holding on right now.
Let's take a look at that Brewers Reds game. One of the more fun games to watch on the schedule just because there was so much offense. Reds currently holding a 16-10 advantage right now. Aroldis Chapman about to finish it off right here in the ninth inning. So assuming that score holds, let's take a look at some of the big contributors for today. Really, it was a grand slam show. Teams combined for 3 grand slams on the day, and that's pretty much what was the undoing for Mike Fiers. Only charged for 4 of those runs, but did leave in the 4th inning after giving up 8 runs and after surrendering a grand slam, I believe it was, to Todd Frazier is what knocked him out of the game. Also surrendered a grand slam to Jay Bruce. Not off to a great start for Mike Fiers, but really the same thing could be said for all of the Brewers. Do you think Mike Fiers is a guy that bounces back as, you know, the year wears on?
It's troubling. I liked Fiers, really. I did coming into the year, but, you know, the starts so far have been pretty poor. I mean, only 4 of the 8 earned runs against him tonight were earned. 3 walks, 4 Ks, but the 2 homers allowed were really bad, especially just so flat. Just so flat, and I don't know. We actually got a Twitter question from one of our listeners asking us if we would drop either Chris Tillman or Fiers for Anthony DeSclafani. I wouldn't drop Tillman, but I'm actually kind of leaning towards, you know, I think I may drop Fiers for DeSclafani, to be honest. Call me a homer, but I really don't like what I've seen from Fiers.
I definitely do the same thing. I think the main appeal with Fiers is just the amount of strikeouts that he gets, but he also is prone to, I think, allowing, you know, more blow-up outings like this type that we saw on Tuesday night. And, you know, the way DeSclafani has pitched, I think there is a lot of sustainability to that. The control has been great so far. And, you know, even if he doesn't necessarily, you know, blow hitters away, he's inducing enough weak contact and not making mistakes with his pitches where I think what he can do is, you know, sustainable for the most part.
Yeah, really efficient. I mean, last night I was actually in Milwaukee at Miller Park to see him throw, and he was cruising. I mean, he probably could have gone complete game, but they ended up taking him out after 8. And the 3-pitch mix, he doesn't really have any overpowering, truly, you know, plus offering or anything. But I think he's got enough with that 3-pitch mix to, you know, sustain success. Had some issues with the Marlins last season, but he seems to be pulling it all together. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I understand the hesitation to drop Fires, especially after that, you know, insane run at the end of last season. But we've seen so far this year that that success, you know, doesn't carry over necessarily, and it has not for him. I think it may be time to make that move.
And at least, even though it looks like the Brewers are going to get the loss here, the silver lining was that the offense at least put some runs on the board for a change. Was the Scrubs really that kind of stepped up and powered the Brewers' offense? Two injury fill-ins, really. Martin Maldonado, as we mentioned, is replacing Jonathan Lucroy behind the plate. He connected on his first homer of the year. It was a two-run shot. And Elian Herrera replacing Scooter Jeanette, who was placed on the DL. He went 2-for-5 with a home run and five RBIs. He hit the third grand slam of the game, finished with three runs while batting the two-hole. Maldonado is a little bit intriguing to me, I guess, in, you know, deeper leagues, just because of most leagues do start two catchers. But Elian Herrera, a guy that's bounced around a lot of teams, I'm not really putting too much stock in this performance.
No, not at all with him, especially because not only is Scooter Jeanette expected back after the minimum 15 days, but also got Hector Gomez in there. I think Hector Gomez will actually probably see the majority of the playing time while Jeanette's out. And yeah, not much to get excited about. You'll see that five spot in the RBI column for Herrera. Just ignore that. He's not really an option, even in shallow NL or deep NL only leagues. Maldonado, I'm with you though, with the 4 to 6 week absence expected for Lucroy. I mean, just for the amount of playing time, I mean, you have to give him some consideration.
And if there are any other questions that you want to throw our way about future, you know, lineup decisions or how you want to process your fab bids, as always, reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at WolfmanTweets. Clay is at ClayWLink, or you can email us at fantasybaseballpodcast@gmail.com. We're happy to answer any questions. Really, it makes this whole process easier and a little bit less repetitive if you, you know, just throw us a question our way and try to get our take on it. I know you had the Desclafani question today. That's perfect type of question if you just want to, you know, ask if player A is better than player B.
Yeah, exactly. Please do. I mean, I like those toss-ups. I mean, especially when there's, you know, differing answers between you and I. You know, not always helpful for the listener when there's not a, you know, consensus answer. But I think that's, you know, if the listeners are wondering, I think it's good to see both sides, really.
And that'll do it for the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast powered by DraftKings.com. Again, if you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher and can please rate and review the podcast, we really appreciate any and all feedback that we can get. Clay and Jake will be back with you tomorrow.